Recently, on one glorious summer Saturday, noting that the day had indeed commenced with the promise of set fair as indicated on my barometer, I submitted to carpe diem and seized the opportunity of tending the lawn. There being quite a lot of said lawn, I tackled it all in the one session instead of over the more usual two, and was rewarded with the muscle aches to prove it. So, with the other various human and animal occupants of Chamois idling in their own secret somewheres, I felt I had earned a bit of me time with my feet up. Add a large glass of America's finest cask-strength bourbon, and I, too, was set fair. Regular followers of my ramblings will know my home is devoid of TV. Lob an arm in any direction, and you will connect with either a cat or a radio. So, adjusting the tuning dial on one of the cats, I stumbled across some station or other playing oldies. Track of the moment was Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side from 1972. The reason my ears pricked up at this gritty urban portrait, describing a series of individuals on their way to New York with its visceral references to then-taboo subjects including transvestites, male prostitution, drugs and sexual practices, is that it whisked me back to that same year, 1972, and a similarly sunny Saturday in the north of England during my undergraduate days. I was never what one would call a gifted student, and was covetous of my fellows who could suck in knowledge as if they were straw. The attainment of my modest clutch of qualifications necessitated much time-consuming graft woven in a matrix of frustration at my intellectual inadequacies. The amount of hair I pulled out, I wonder I'm not bald. But a lazy Saturday afternoon was one luxury I granted myself, if only to recharge the batteries and stay sane. There I was in the refectory, where I noticed a solitary man seated at a table, despite numerous other people sitting disinterestedly at other tables nearby. He looked lonely, so I asked if I could join him. "Please do," he replied softly. "I'm Howard." Let me describe Howard. Mid-twenties, chisel-featured, ascetically thin but finely proportioned. I guess he would have nudged way over 6 feet tall in his stocking toes, and his long flaxen locks hung over expensively attired shoulders. He was languidly puffing on a long churchwarden pipe, and as the wisps of smoke wafted past his cheeks, I couldn't avoid noticing that his eyes, fixed in the middle distance, were twin pools of sadness. We sat quietly for some minutes before I broke the silence and inquired if he was okay. He heaved a sigh of despair, looked me in the eye, and poured out, "I am heartbroken. My boyfriend has just left me." How upsetting is that? Howard, you see, was the chair of the local group of what was then known as the Gay Liberation Front. It all fell into place. Students may assume polarised political views, but they are, in my experience, generally libertarian in personal attitudes. Thus, whilst I'm not aware that Howard was victimised for his sexuality, as was prevalent in the big bad world beyond the comfort zone of academia, I am prepared to accept that those quite literally on the outside were oblivious to his angst and simply did not know how to react. Perhaps, and I do not criticise them for their ignorance, they didn't even try, and instead just chose to walk on the other side. I understand there's a story in the Bible that runs along similar lines. Howard and I chatted until well into late afternoon. I never saw him again, but that one meeting educated the youthful me in just how desperately isolated some people can feel simply because they are what they are. The mind doth work in curious ways, and no sooner had I remembered Howard, I linked to memories of a man from the same era, George, whom I worked alongside in my holidays, to earn a bit of bread, man. And I still reel at his pain when this dignified and unassumingly quintessential English businessman learnt that his son was a transvestite and suspected homosexual. His spirit was broken more than his pride, and shortly afterwards, although not recorded as such on his certificate, George died of shame. Fast forward to half a century later, where we do not bat an eyelid at the likes of comedian Eddie Izzard and artist Grayson Perry, who are known as much for their feminine attire as they are for their talents. Such once-debauched conduct is fated, with the gay pride movement embracing lesbians, gays, transvestites, bisexuals, transsexuals, non-binary, non-identifying, and more in a cornucopia of those declaring an alternative lifestyle. There will surely come a time when the term alternative becomes an irrelevance and everything becomes part of the mainstream because, well, everything is mainstream. Since my naive encounter with Howard, I now revel in the company of numerous gay friends and family members happy to declare their sexuality and feeling similarly unthreatened. Lest we forget, there are countries and cultures that lag way behind us in acceptance, and in an increasingly globalised world, therein lies a challenge. It's not insurmountable, it may just take time. 125 years after The Love That Dare Not Speak Its Name, a phrase from the 1892 poem Two Loves by Lord Alfred Douglas, was pejoratively cited at Oscar Wilde's trial. That very same love is now recognised, acknowledged, rejoiced and celebrated. Within the grand scheme of social evolution, this is a speedy transformation. It was only in 1967 that the Sexual Offences Act repealed elements of sexual criminality. Not all, but it was a start. Though the trend is progressive, it is not a perfect process, and there are occasional stutters. The provisions of Section 28 of the Local Government Act of 1988, widely described at the time as a step backwards, sought to ban the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities and in Britain's schools. Promotion, as used by the Thatcher government, was a contentious word. More accurately, the clause meant in practice that teachers were effectively barred from discussing same-sex relationships with students, and councils were forbidden from stocking libraries with literature or films that contained gay or lesbian themes. Amidst tumultuous opposition, the clause was repealed first in Scotland and then England. In 2009, David Cameron apologised for Clause 28 and admitted it had been a mistake. A contemporary example of attempts to reconcile opposing views is panning out under public gaze at the very moment I'm writing this, whereby the Scottish Government is deliberating over a piece of legislation seeking to criminalise allegedly offensive language against minorities, including personal opinion and satire, as a hate crime. Depending on one's view, this is either a safeguarding of those minorities' rights or a grotesque attack on free speech and humour. There's just no absolute answer to that dichotomy, and, as usual, a compromise will probably lie somewhere down the middle. But these examples do illustrate the difficulties in reaching a resolution, and what may happen when the resolution itself be thrust into obsolescence as society's own attitudes change. There is a difference between reparation and rewriting history. Much as we may be tempted to remove unsavoury chapters from our past, there is no nation on earth that doesn't have its dark chapters. To eradicate them from future recountings would not only be a travesty of the truth, it would also deny us the opportunity to learn from those mistakes and modify our attitudes accordingly. As the novelist and philosopher George Santayana put it succinctly, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. We should be Catholic, small c, in accepting our mistakes and refer to them as a springboard to inform our future actions. We cannot do this if they are erased from history. It is now considered monstrous that the genius mathematician Alan Turing, he of Bletchley Park code-breaking fame, should have elected chemical castration rather than prison. What a choice, eh? For submitting to the love that dare not speak its name. Try to imagine the torment of the man who felt his best option was to swallow a cyanide capsule in 1954, aged just 41. His pardon by Prime Minister Gordon Brown in 2009 for the appalling way he was treated could, of course, never bring Turing back. But the recognition of the historical facts does help alter the trajectory of our route along the never-ending path to ultimate social enlightenment. Not merely a step forward, but genuine progress. And so, after 50 years of liberation, changes in law, public displays, pressure groups, characters and celebrities, in which the whole scene has gone totally volte-face from Wilde's time of incarceration in Reading Jail. I was saddened to hear recently of a celebrated footballer who, despite his trappings of fame and wealth, admitted to missing companionship because he is afraid of revealing he is gay. Justin Fashanu was the first black professional footballer to openly proclaim being gay way back in 1990. And although he paid a terrible price for his admission, the note accompanying his suicide in 1998 was testament to his distress. After 3 decades, his coming out no longer sets any precedent. Yet, here in 2020, there are still those whom, for whatever reason, are fearful of the consequences of revealing themselves simply because they are what they are. Why must our fellows of any sexual orientation feel tormented to the extent they take their own life? My overarching question is, why does it still matter when, in the final analysis, it is a purely personal consideration that is nobody else's business? My answer, or should I say my fervent hope, is that it will eventually diminish to the point that it does not. Looking beyond the gay scene, that same question and answer session applies equally to the catalogue of society's current ailments: racism, sexism, religious intolerance, ageism, etc., etc., etc. When we strike the balance of equating the inadequacies of our past with using them to constructively inform our future, a natural and logical consequence will be that they will all cease to be an issue. In the pursuit of that utopia, more aspirational than practical, I admit, but it is our civic duty to try, we have a long way to go, and it is in the nature of the human condition that there are those who choose alternative routes. Should forbearance and tolerance continue to grow, then it will be to our universal good fortune that all sides get less wild by the day. And on that optimistic reflection, I would like to dedicate this piece in memory of songwriter Lou Reed, who embarked on his own last walk on the wild side when he died of liver complications on the 27th of October 2013, aged 71.